And we're just looking at a few pictures and some things that I've thought about, and I must say, as I prepared for today, something came up that I really wasn't anticipating when I was getting my thoughts together for speaking. So Jesus did most of his ministry time in the area called Galilee. He was there for about a year and a half. And the reason he went there is, well, just before that. So this is the Sea of Galilee, and we've talked about this before. We think of lakes like Lake Erie and Lake St. Clair. Well, the Sea of Galilee, although they call it a sea, or they call it Lake Tiberias or Lake Gennesaret or a bunch of other names, it was only 13 miles long in its longest length and 7 miles across at its widest breadth. And the area that Jesus actually spent his time in was just this area. He, as far as we know, never went into Tiberias, which was the capital city of Galilee. He went on the road that ran down this way towards Jerusalem, and this is the Via Maris. This is actually the road that goes from Egypt all the way through into Iran and Iraq. It goes along the coast, and then about Mount Carmel in Israel, cuts through the center part of Israel, and then continues on. Right here is what they call the Mount of Beatitudes, where Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount. So I have some pictures that I took from that spot. This is looking along the length of the Sea of Galilee, and I showed these the last time I spoke. We're up on that Mount of Beatitudes. There's a church there. And we're looking down the length of the Sea of Galilee. And I've got just a small camera. It's got a 20-power zoom on it, but that's not 20 times. It's when they talk about a 20-power zoom. But I'm saying that because I want you to understand that it's not big. Because when we read in the Gospels, we'll read about people walking along the shore to where they saw Jesus going. And when I was a kid, I never understood that. We're looking towards the city of Tiberias, which was there at Jesus' time and is still there now, still called Tiberias. And again, we're looking from what's called the Sea of Galilee. And these little specks you see here are boats that are out there right now. Or not now, but at the time I took the picture. We're looking the other direction. I'm facing south. So east is on the left. So we're looking at the east side of the Sea of Galilee. This is the area where the demon-possessed man and the Gerasenes was. Further along here, there's a city that was up on the hill called Hippos. This is the area called the Decathlon, which was a Greek area, non-Jewish area. This is looking towards the town of Capernaum from that area of where Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount. So right here is where the town of Capernaum was. So where Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount was just up from the town of Capernaum. Over this way was the town of Bethsaida, where James and John, Peter and Andrew came from. The Jordan River. Actually, Bethsaida is probably over here more. The Jordan River, I think, cuts through about here, coming from the north. This is looking at the pass that is the road that goes from Nazareth coming into Galilee. So that's how Jesus arrived in Galilee. Oh, wrong way. And this is looking from the water up where the Mount of Beatitudes was. This is a model of the kind of fishing boat they said that Jesus would have been in when the disciples talk about being in a boat. And I saw this next picture. It was on the internet. It's kind of cool. I think there's 7 people in the boat. There was a boat that they found that is about 2,000 years old. It was found in the mud of the Sea of Galilee. And it's, if my memory is right, it's about 25 feet long and about 7 feet across and would hold Jesus and his disciples. Would hold maybe 15. So why did Jesus go to Galilee? We already talked about this in terms of in Galilee was a method of discipleship that Jesus adopted. The idea of discipleship in Galilee was you would follow a rabbi and you would become like the rabbi. You actually wouldn't become like the rabbi, you would become the rabbi. You would spend your time with him. You would eat like him. You would sleep where he slept. You would spend your days with him. You would learn to become this person. And we read in the Gospels that Jesus picked 12 to be with him. And Jesus says, when you are fully trained, you will be like your teacher. And if we think of that method of discipleship, statements that Jesus makes make a little more sense when Jesus would say, you will do the things that I do. In North America, when we think about discipleship, we think of a Greek model. And what's a Greek model? We have to realize that the time of Greece had already passed, but the influence of the Greek culture carried through into Rome, carried through into Israel, carried throughout the whole known world. But the Greek model was that I'm an individual. I am the supreme. Supreme is a little too much, but this is me. And I would go to an individual from whom I will learn things that will make me better, that will make me a better person, and that we basically live our lives alone. Sure, we're in a community, but we live alone as individuals, taking things from other people that we will learn to make ourselves better. And now, nowadays, there's this whole idea of accountability, where if I'm in a men's discipleship group, the main purpose of that group, and maybe I'm being a little harsh when I say the main, one of the purposes of which is for me to say what I've done wrong and to be accountable to other people. It's like a police group. It's behavioral modification. Here's what Paul said. Now, could you imagine if I was to set up a disciple group and to say the first meeting, I want all of you to be me? We would laugh. But what does Paul say? I want you to imitate me. What did Jesus say? When a disciple is fully trained, he will be like his teacher. So, we're going to talk about the feeding of the 5,000 and then the 4,000. And so we have the setting. We're in Jesus' final year of ministry. He has had a year of unparalleled success in Galilee. But some things have happened. Jesus has sent out the 12. They've come back and they've given a report. And the 12, the disciples, are excited about what has happened, about what has happened through them. But something else sad has happened. John the Baptist has been killed. And Jesus has just received the word of John the Baptist being killed. So we're going to read in a minute remember if we're reading in Matthew or Mark, but we'll get there. This is just a different map. It's actually an aerial photograph. In Luke, the feeding of the 5,000, according to Luke, takes place in a place called Bethsaida. Well, there's two Bethsaidas, which makes it a little confusing. There's Bethsaida, where James and John, Peter and Andrew come from. Here's Capernaum. Jesus had his men get in a boat and go to Bethsaida, and this is a small town where they probably were for the feeding of the 5,000. At the end of that time, we talked about this the last time I spoke, Jesus had his guys get in a boat and go back to Capernaum. The wind blew them the wrong direction. So after the feeding of the 5,000, they started rowing for Capernaum. They ended up in the Gennesaret Valley, which is here. Tiberias is down here. Magdala, which we're going to refer to in a minute, is over here. So I have all the scriptures from Mark. I'd forgotten which one we were going to read from. So you could follow along here. You can open up your Bibles if you wish. The apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. Then, because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, he said to them, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest." So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. I'm just going to stop there. Solitary place basically means deserted farmland. Okay, it means property that wasn't being used. So we'll continue reading. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. By this time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. "This is a remote place," they said, "and it's already very late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "That would take more than half a year's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat?" "How many loaves do you have?" he asked. "Go and see." When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in the groups of hundreds and fifties. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. The number of the men who had eaten was 5,000. So this was a miracle, obviously. What's kind of interesting, and I referred last time I spoke to Michael Card, the singer, his commentary on Mark. He refers to it as a very unmiraculous miracle. The wording doesn't say anything great. They got this fish and the loaves. Jesus broke them, passed them out, fed I don't know how many people. It says 5,000 men. So it's an interesting little understated miracle. John, in his account, and this is the only miracle that is recorded in all 4 Gospels. So we have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. John, in his account, adds this, what the people's reaction were, as the people realized what had happened. So remember, it's not like Jesus got up and said, "Okay, I got 7 loaves, 2 fish, I'm going to feed all of you." They didn't realize what had happened till after the fact. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. So John remembers that. He has some other details. The details that he remembers from this account is that he had said to Philip, "Where are you going to get? How are we going to feed all these people?" And then Andrew brought the 5 loaves and 2 fish. So the people want to take Jesus and fit him into their concept of who Jesus was. This is what I didn't think I was going to be saying when I started thinking about what I was going to say. I'm still thinking about what I'm going to say. We have a view of life that allows us to live. This life, this view of life, is based on our cultural, our heritage, our families, things that have happened to us in our lives. We conduct our lives based on this view of life. So what's all this mean? Well, I'll give you an example. Occasionally, Gail and I have an argument. Now, I know probably no other married couple here ever has arguments. But if you are like us, we have different styles of arguing. I don't know how true that is in your family. And for I don't know how many years, we've been married 35 years in a week. You can send us a present if you want. Cash. Gift cards. But we argue in different ways. And I am thoroughly convinced that the way I argue is the correct way to argue. And Gail is thoroughly convinced that the way she argues is the correct way. And we've reached a point in our lives, and actually Gail would have a better understanding of this for herself than I do, as to why she argues the way she does and why she reacts to how I argue. And it's because of events in her life that have molded her into who she is today. So as our lives together went along, I would argue that we're arguing over arguing techniques, and that we had to realize that they were just differences, that neither one was right or wrong. I just argued one way, she argued the other, the two met and conflicted. But I realized something, and it's only something that I've realized in the past few years, is my statement of they're just arguing techniques and they're both accepted is totally wrong. The way that I view life is absolutely wrong. What's that mean? We talk about a major theological concept, the total depravity of man. And in that, we talk about we're sinners, we're separated from God, and we do things that are wrong. But I don't think we really understand how deep that comes into our lives and how much it interferes with our ability to interact with each other. My way of arguing was wrong. And Gail's way of arguing is wrong. It's not that we meet somewhere in the middle. We have to realize both ways are absolutely wrong. I've referred to an author, John Eldridge, a few times. And he wrote a book on marriage called Love and War. And I'm sure that describes many of our marriages. Sometimes the war part more than the love. Our brokenness combines with our sin and produces a style of relating, an approach to life which frees us so which to us feels so utterly justified and so perfectly reasonable, but in fact is the very thing that will destroy us and all those around us. So I have a way of relating. Gail has a way of relating, and both of those ways are not God's way of relating. Both of those ways are wrong. This is also true with respect to whom we believe Jesus is and how it is we are to follow him. So Jesus fed the 5,000 people. They said, "This is the prophet like Moses," which I think is biblical. And they wanted to take him and make him king. But their view of Jesus was wrong. 12 baskets were gathered. So in John, the account in John, Jesus says, and I understand this is what a rabbi would say, let's not waste food. Go out among the field and gather up all of the leftovers. And they gathered up 12 baskets of leftovers. So there are two different words used for baskets in these two different miracles, because in both miracles, they gathered up leftovers. In this first miracle, when Jesus fed 5,000, now, I don't speak Greek. I have trouble with English. But somebody who speaks Greek, and I read this, said, the basket used here was a small lunch basket. So Jesus fed 5,000. The disciples went out and canvassed the area, which was a very rabbinical thing to do, gathered up the leftovers, and there was enough for each of them to have lunch. When Jesus fed 4,000, it's a different word used. And in the four accounts of the 5,000, the same word is used, lunch basket, which we'll call lunch basket. In the feeding of the 4,000 in Matthew and Mark, the same word is used, which is a word for a large man-sized hamper, which is the same word used when Paul was let down of Damascus in the basket as they dropped him over the city wall. Paul escaped in this hamper. We'll come back to that. So now we're going to read the second feeding, the 4,000. So I mentioned that Jesus had a year and a half of unparalleled, his ministry just exploded. People were coming from all over. In fact, they were coming from all over so much, as we just read in Mark, that the guys couldn't even eat. So Jesus left Galilee. He goes north. And then he comes south. So here's a map. So here's Capernaum. They go up to Tyre up here. Then they come back probably this way, avoiding all of Galilee, and come down into the area called the Decapolis. So in Matthew 15, and I'm going to read this account. Jesus left there and went along the Sea of Galilee. Then he went up on a mountainside and sat down. Great crowds came to him, bringing the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, and laid them at his feet. He healed them. The people were amazed when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled made well, the lame walking, and the blind seeing. And they praised the God of Israel. And just stop there. I just want to remind you that right now Jesus is in the more Greek area along the Sea of Galilee called the Decapolis. So this was not a Jewish area, although there were Jewish people there. He's now ministering to much of the audience is non-Jewish. So we're continuing on in Matthew. Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. I do not want to send them away hungry, or they may collapse on the way. His disciple answered, where could we get enough bread in this remote place to feed such a crowd? How many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. Seven, they replied, and a few small fish. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. Then he took the seven loaves and the fish, and when he had given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples, and they in turn to the people. They all ate and were satisfied. Afterwards, the disciples picked up seven basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. The number of these who ate was 4,000 men, besides women and children. After this, Jesus sent the crowd away. He got into the boat and went to the vicinity of Magadan, which is the town of Magdala. So Jesus again feeds, I don't know how many people. Does the number really matter? I mean, whether he fed 5,000 or 7,000 or 10,000, that number is not relevant. It's interesting that in these accounts, how much bread they picked up was relevant. And Michael Card, as he's describing these two miracles, calls the first one a miracle of perfect provision. They had enough for whoever was there and lunch for themselves. And the second miracle was they had more than they knew what to do with. They picked up seven man-sized hampers full of food after he fed however many were there, the thousands that were there. Well, now Jesus gets back in the boat. So here we read he's on one side of the Sea of Galilee. He goes across to the other side. And then he gets in the boat and goes back. Well, the only time he could get away from the people is when he was in a boat. I mean, it sounds silly, but it makes sense. Because when you're standing anywhere on the Sea of Galilee, you can look out, spot the boat, and they're going there. You can walk faster than they can row. So you get there ahead of them, which makes sense to me, but didn't make sense when I was a kid. So we're continuing on, and we're reading this time in Mark, not Matthew. So Jesus has gotten in the boat. He's crossed over the sea, crossed over the lake, and they're at Magdala. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given it. Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side. So he crosses the lake to have what sounds like a conversation. Then he gets back in the boat and crosses over again. It was really the only time he could be with his disciples by themselves. So as we continue on in Mark, the disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. Be careful, Jesus warned them. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and of Herod. They discussed this with one another and said, it is because we have no bread. Aware of their discussion, and I just pause there for a second. Just remember how big that boat is. I find it funny, they think they're going to have a little conversation with Jesus not hearing. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 12. When I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many hamperfuls of pieces did you pick up?" They said, 7. He said to them, and I could just picture a sigh as he said this, "Do you still not understand?" And Matthew, in his account, says, Jesus said to them, "Don't you know I'm not talking about bread?" So, what was going on with the disciples? These two feedings occurred only a couple of months apart. It's not like it was 5 years ago and now. And just think of all the things that had gone on between them. Did they really not see? And this is where it ties into what I had said before about when the people wanted to squeeze Jesus into their mold. Or did they see who Jesus was and they were afraid? Did they retreat into what they knew was comfortable? What's that mean? Their usual method of dealing with life. My daughter is getting her master's of business, and we were talking about work. And whenever she complains about it being a lot of work, I just laugh and I say, it's a master's level. It better be a lot of work. And we were talking about work, and I said that I have major pathological work habits. That's my comfort. I retreat into work. It is destructive for me and my family, but it's comfortable. It's easy to do. And I'm still doing it after all these years. And the disciples, it's a whole lot easier to think of Jesus as being a good teacher than being God. And all of that, what that means. And when he says to them, "You will do greater things than what I do," what's that mean? So were the disciples really thick-headed, or were they doing the same thing that many of us do? We retreat to our comfort zones. And what did Jesus say when you don't get it? I had somebody in the office the other day who blames absolutely everything that goes on in her life as satanic attacks. And I kind of smugly go, "Yeah, right. Well, I mean, you've made a lot of crappy choices in life, too." But when I looked at this past week of what's gone on in Gail's in my life, the analytical Northern European mindset of mine wants to make it all just what I can see and nothing else, and to pretend the spiritual doesn't even exist, because that's what I'm comfortable with. Because a life that I can't see is out of my control. And sitting in a boat with God is amazingly out of my control. Do we see through spiritual eyes? We talked about the two storms. And the one storm, when a hurricane force wind came down on the Sea of Galilee, and how pretty well every commentary you read will say, well, there's winds that come down from Mount Hebron, and because it's below sea level, storms can arise. But as one commentary said, Jesus was in the boat with all of his disciples. Why couldn't it be satanic? Because then he lands and he heals a demon-possessed man. We don't look at life through spiritual eyes. Hardly any of us do. I had this thought, and I never really looked it up. How many people in the gospel accounts actually got who Jesus was? And as I just clicked in my mind, the only one I could really think of was the centurion. And maybe one or two others. And failing to see life through spiritual eyes makes them like Herod, who wanted to see a sign, or the Pharisees, who wanted to see a sign. But Jesus was changing absolutely everything of what they thought. So I have a view of life, how I conduct my life, that is so right to me, that carries over into everything, how I interpret the Bible, how I look at Jesus, how I pray, how I act with my family. And I am absolutely convinced that I am right. And part of that, I also believe my goal in life is to make everybody else like me. That my way is correct, that the way I run my family is correct, the way that I work is correct. But I'm beginning to realize that it's wrong. My view of life, the life that I've constructed out of my upbringing, my culture, my heritage, things that have happened to me, how I have interpreted life events, is all wrong. If that was the end of the story, man, we might as well just go out and kill ourselves or drink ourselves silly. But you know, the message of Christianity is that we will be new creations. God has put in us a new heart. That's what sanctification is. That's what holiness is becoming who Jesus said we can be. It's not what we think of it. That's me learning how to fight with my wife in a way that God actually wants me to. It sounds weird, we're supposed to fight, but probably marriage is the first method God has for making us holy people, because the first thing we learn is what I'm doing is screwed up. And if we don't learn that, if we never learn that, we'll just go through life with, it's a mess, and we leave a mess around us and we're not even aware of it. But the promise is, if any man is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away, new things have come. Jesus wants us to let him be who he said he is, not who we want him to be, not who we think he is. And as we let the new life in us come out, then we will be like him. Let's bow our heads and we'll close in prayer. Lord, we have much to learn. And sometimes we have a lot to unlearn. I have a way that I live that just seems so perfect. And yet it's nothing at all the way that you have for me, that you made me to be. Lord, you have put a new heart in me. You've made me a new creation. I don't have to go that old road. Show me who you are. Amen.